You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 59.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
All right, the broadcast is live. We're live. Well,
awesome.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to The Local Maximum. This is episode 59 of The Local Maximum, and the second one that we're live streaming. Actually, Aaron, I think this is the first one that we're live streaming. We might actually get it right this time, where we're actually switching sides. So the downside of live streaming is, so first of all, let me actually introduce the title of today's, I don't know if it's the title, but the theme in today's podcast is the internet and cryptocurrency in authoritarian regimes. Particularly, we're going to be talking about Cuba and Venezuela, which are kind of related regimes. They're both, you know, socialist, Caribbean, or, well, Venezuela is, I don't know if they would consider it Caribbean, but anyway, they're close to each other.
They have a Caribbean coast.
Yes, allied to each other countries. Both have some similar issues, and so we're going to talk about that. First of all, isn't it great on live stream how now people can see this ridiculous sunburn I got while skiing? So I don't know why anyone would want to listen to me if I can't figure out how to keep my face protected, but oh well. First, I want to react to the latest Joe Rogan podcast. I feel like I'm reacting a little too much to Joe Rogan. It's not like, this is not the Joe Rogan reaction show. But no, this is a topic that we've been talking about a lot when it comes to Twitter. If you remember episode 25, that's probably last summer, I talked about Twitter's war on bots and also their kind of war on, I guess, harassment and content moderation and how bias can be introduced into that. And so I think that Joe Rogan and had Jack Dorsey back on his program to discuss it. And he also had a couple other people. Vijaya Gadi was her name. She was the another trust and safety person. Yeah, I love the trust and safety person, but that's kind of a lawyer.
So when Dorsey was on the previous time, did he come alone or?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, so both Rogan and Dorsey brought back up this time.
Right. And I think she was there because she was more of an expert in their policy and on the specific cases that they were talking about. And maybe to keep
one
of
the
trouble,
great things about that discussion was they got into real specifics. And it wasn't just what's the policy, how is it enforced. It was, so this particular person did this particular thing.
Yeah.
How did that lead to them getting disciplined, and what was the form of discipline?
And Tim Pool, who had a lot of sounds like he had a lot of personal experience with this. I thought it was an amazing discussion. I thought that, this is the discussion that people are going to refer back to, 5-10 years from now. It'll be interesting.
Data is not the plural of anecdote. And I think a lot of what we saw were anecdotal cases.
Sure.
But this is the most comprehensive and most in-depth insight into the inner workings that at least I have seen up to this point. So it's pulling back the curtain on a lot of, not necessarily unveiling something that, it's scandalous that this is how they're doing it, but there wasn't this level of transparency on individual cases prior to this.
Right. And some people say, this is not important. It's just about these jerk faces being removed from Twitter. Who cares about that? And in fact, there are some jerks being removed from Twitter, and many of whom came up in that discussion. But you have to be able to see this is much more than that. This is also about, the stuff that we see online affects our worldview greatly, and it affects, our consumer behavior. It affects the way we vote. And so I thought Tim Pool was a little bit late, a little bit on thick, that they had kind of a, it seemed to me like he felt they had an obligation to uphold our democracy, which I'm not really sure. I don't know. I felt that went a little too far. Maybe.
Yeah, he was making a pretty hard argument in that they have become the public square And as such, they have a higher responsibility than the classic, well, they're a private company and they can do whatever they want as long as they don't break the law, which he's not the first and certainly won't be the last to make that argument. But it's open to some interpretation whether you choose to align with that.
Well, I think what's interesting is just ask them about, hey, they claim that they want to be an open system for anyone to talk. And I see some individual cases where that's not happening. Why is that not happening? And then I see, you know, overall bias, particularly political bias, which again, like I said back in episode 25, and I think we repeated in later episodes, is that of course they're going to have a political bias because everyone in their company has the same political leaning, left leaning. And, you know, even if they, I don't think they're actually going ahead and trying to, you know, bias their system like that. But just like, you know, at Foursquare, if I were to only care about my favorite restaurants, well, they're going to only care about their favorite issues. And so I call that QA bias.
You're stipulating an unconscious, not a malicious.
Right,
bias.
And I think that's what came to light here. So I really think Jack Dorsey gets a lot of hate online, but I think that they were both actually trying to make a good effort here. Both sides of the issue kind of had their facts, and both sides actually had to be corrected at times. And I think they genuinely wanted to get better as opposed to other platforms who might not go on a show like this. You know, sometimes Vijaya can speak from like a legalistic company perspective, which is really irritating for me, but I understand why she has to do it. That's her job. And so I just, I think that there are just certain narratives that they favor and are given much more attention. But I just think by going on the show, they're kind of showing that, hey, we're going to try to change this. But I think in the end, properly moderating Twitter at a global or even just a national scale is really an impossible task. And I think Jack Dorsey is kind of thinking, well, we're going to try to do the best we can here with Twitter. But also I'm going to move on to the crypto world, which is why we have this announcement today that he's hiring engineers to work to improve Bitcoin directly as his payment company Square embraces it. So that's really interesting because the M. Tim Pool is like, well, I'm not satisfied with you guys and everyone's going to move to cryptocurrencies. And I'm like, that's what the guy is doing. You know, so I thought that was pretty interesting. And I thought it was interesting that he didn't pipe up and say something when that was going on. When the other guy was saying that.
Well, in terms of the whole ongoing Twitter fiasco, yeah. I would say that Dorsey seems very much like the type of person that if I ran into him at a party, not that I go to those kind of parties, but I would have no problem chatting with him, you know, sharing a drink and walk away saying, oh, he seems like a decent guy. But having your heart in the right place and saying, you know, I want to make this better, I want to solve this problem, and actually being able to solve it are two very different things. And I think
it could be impossible.
One is a prerequisite to the other.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make solving that easy. And he's got a long, hard road ahead of him.
Well, it's not like
that's going to be, you know,
it's not
flanked on all sides by critics.
It's not like I think it's like possible to solve and he's just, you know, not competent enough. I think it's just the fact that it's such a complicated problem. But yeah, I think I don't think they're going to fix their particular bias anytime soon. But, you know, hey, that's all right. He's at the same time, he's working on ways around it himself. So what can what more can you ask for? I kind of feel like. All right, I just felt like we had to mention that because we had covered that previously on the show. I'll link to the articles about that, and I'll link to episode 25, which is at localmaxradio.com/25. Any further questions for me on that? Was I clear? Was there anything?
So I wasn't aware of the recent crypto related announcement.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know that there's much to go into in detail on that now, but it sounds like that's something that we may want to talk about in the future as it takes more form.
Oh, yeah. Sure. So he's actually hiring engineers to work directly on the Bitcoin protocol. Like, he's like, you will report directly to me and I will pay you, which I find really interesting. So it's not actually, it's not just about building his own system around it.
Say working on the Bitcoin protocol, are we talking about, I assume it's some sort of open source project,
exactly.
Essentially. So this is much like there are some folks or folks who are able to spend some of their time at like Google or the Mozilla Foundation working on the open source products in their family or those open source products which are immediately adjacent to what they're working on company time.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. And so, you know, he's adding to that network. He's incorporating cryptocurrency into the Cash App, which is Square's app. I haven't used that yet. I should give that a try, but seems pretty fascinating. All right, let's move on to, because I said I only wanted to talk about this for 10 minutes. We might get some questions about it, and if we do, localmaxradio@gmail.com. We'll try to answer it on the show. Let's look at this. So I'm going to start with this AP article, Cell Phone Internet Access Bringing Changes Fast to Cuba. And I should point out that I was in Cuba last year, last February. So you read this, Aaron, correct?
Yes.
So tell me what you thought about that and what your impression was. And I could tell you what I saw.
It was, I guess there were a couple of things. One, it's exciting because not only are they getting access to kind of the modern world by jumping on the internet, but they're coming from almost no connectivity to that, jumping straight into a 3G world, which it's mind-boggling to think of what that kind of shift is like. The flip side of that,
3G though, is a little like dial-up, though, if you think about it.
But imagine coming from the equivalent of where they are now and jumping straight into that.
Yeah. Also, dial-up, like the internet had nothing on it. Now when you have 3G, you still have the whole internet available.
Right. Yeah. The flip side of that coin, though, is that here in the U.S. and in Europe and other parts of the world, everybody's worried about monolithic tech companies and the surveillance state and how they're monitoring everything we do and monetizing it and they're not paying us for the use of our data. But in Cuba, until very recently, if you did anything on the internet, you did it through a government sponsored connection. So it would be foolish to presume anything other than they were monitoring everything. And if you had an email, it was through a government run ISP. And so we at least have options between, a half dozen,
I'm pretty sure that's still true,
evil or less evil companies.
Yeah.
But can you imagine what it would be like if your email was, if everybody in the US had a .gov email address,
yeah,
and the expectation was that the IRS and the FBI and the NSA were reading all of your emails all the time?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't know. So the one platform that I had experience with was Airbnb, chatting to the Airbnb owner through Airbnb.com. I don't know if they can intercept those messages. Maybe they can. I don't know.
Well, if the ISP is government owned then presumably they can. I mean, I don't know that they would.
Well, yeah.
But they certainly could.
No, but that's that's not true. Okay, so yeah, there is and there was also this part of it that concerns their submarine cables. That's sort of too,
right, which is part of the reason that they claim that they are only able to make this jump now, that they simply didn't have the means of the bandwidth until that was hooked up.
When's now? Because in 2015, you had the public Wi-Fi in parks starting in 2015. It was certainly there. So what's the difference between now and what they had before when I was there?
So my understanding was that now with this massive rollout of the 3G network, like you said, there was this public Wi-Fi in parks, but that's, it was almost like an even more public internet cafe model that literally you had to go to the park to connect to it.
Right.
But now with a more broad based 3G network, people are starting to have access in their own homes, which is a first.
I guess what I don't understand is why would you need the submarine cable for one and not the other? Is it just the amount of bandwidth, or is it
that would be my guess?
Okay.
And honestly, I don't recall from the article when the submarine cable went in.
Right. Okay. So the actually, let's see if we could look that up.
Well, because I think there was something in there about previously they'd been restricted to satellite uplinks.
Oh, no.
Which
yes, they,
are more expensive and limited.
They bandwidth. Got they got a submarine cable in 2011, it says. And then so the submarine cable was actually in 2011. So that was with Venezuela. So yeah, okay. So they did need that for both things. And in 2015, they had the Wi-Fi in the parks. So yeah, that's essentially the recent history. So
And the issue with the submarine cable,
now
like you mentioned, was they had to run it through Venezuela because they claimed that the less communist-friendly nations in the Caribbean were blocking that.
Yeah, so the U.S. and they said the U.S. blocked it and everyone else blocked it, which... that's what the Cuban government says, but others say no, that was just their excuse not to have it. And obviously, if it goes through Venezuela, they have a lot more control over it.
And in fact, my first reaction to that, having not done any detailed research on it, was why would we want to block that? If anything, it would be to our advantage from the viewpoint of a Western democracy that greater access to information is going to only accelerate the toppling of an oppressive regime. So we want a way to get that information into the hands of the people. Why would we try and block the cable? Now, I could see trying to block the cable if the only way to get the cable in would be a cable that has, complete control by the Cuban government.
Right. Or if it's part of the embargo.
But it still seems to me that it would be in our interest. I thought, well, why not have a model similar to the Radio Free Europe that we did in the Cold War?
There's no embargo. But,
modernized. And you pointed out that we did do things like
there's
that.
There's no embargo in there's no embargo for to like Mexico or any of those countries. So it's not like that would affect them there. But yes, so when I went to the Museum of the Revolution, they talked they had a whole wall about the whole
exhibit,
on Cuba-U.S. relations. And they talked about, Radio Marti, Television Marti, and that's kind of their all the things that the U.S. government did to Cuba. This is one of them. So I'm just reading from the museum exhibits that I was in Havana. The so-called Radio Marti, airing on May 20th, 1985, launched the psychological war against Cuba. On September 30th, the U.S. House of Representatives approved $7.5 million to begin the transmission of the badly named Television Marti. Yes, that was the on the caption. They also said it was interfered with by their technicians. In other words, they blocked it, and it was part of the aggressive policy toward our country being Cuba in this case. That's essentially what that was. And actually, I believe that's still going on. So there's still kind of that information campaign happening. But I think the better information campaign is just having people like me and you visit Cuba. So,
yeah. Well, Cuban expats, people who still have family back in Cuba or friends or distant relatives who are now living in Florida or Texas or wherever they've moved to in the United States, being able to communicate back to Cuba more easily and more frequently. It's not that they couldn't do that before, but it's a lot easier if your family member has a Wi-Fi connection or your 3G connection in their home than if you have to go through some complicated complicated gray market, black market solution, or through official government connections.
So let me tell you about these the park Wi-Fi. So you have to buy these cards that give you 1 hour of internet on it. You buy the card so people know who's doing it. The card
and can you just buy those at like any bodega or is
I don't think so.
Special.
I think we got it through our Airbnb host, and I think it's part of like. I don't think you could just get them. I think they're actually very difficult to get. But I could be wrong.
I'm curious.
That. Yeah.
What kind, if any, rationing there? Like, do you purchase them at some retail value, or is it everybody is issued, you know, 1 hour of Wi-Fi a week and you get your card, much like...
I'm not sure, but I got the sense that it was issued, and then it was also issued to tourists through... So, you know, even though they have Airbnbs, maybe there's some hookup where they... But honestly, I didn't ask too many questions. I was just like, okay, great, 1 hour internet, fine. And you fill in, it's got like a username and password, which are both numbers, and you have to like fill in like 30 numbers on your phone, and you get in, and then you start using it, and then the clock starts ticking, and it starts going down.
So that's interesting that it's time-based, not bandwidth-based.
Yeah, well, the bandwidth is slow. We did have one like FaceTime call to the U.S., but it's like very, it looks like this, like... you know, very, very like one photo every 2 seconds kind of.
Well, that's one of the other things that I didn't really think about too much when I was reading the article, but, you mentioned, oh, it's 3G. It's like being back on dial up. While they now have access over that 3G connection or through the Wi-Fi parks to the greater internet. You know, a standard web page today, if you tried to download it over a 3G connection or dial-up, is going to take forever because it's no longer just, you know, simple text or basic HTML. It's got embedded video and
it loads
ads and all sorts of other stuff. And so unless they've got some kind of built-in tools in their infrastructure to kind of strip out all or run a simplified versions of those.
I basically sites, just use
that's
it.
That's going
to
be rough.
I use the check email. I think they probably use it to check like Airbnb email. If it's, you know, it's basically for people to check very simple things from their friends and family. And for people who run businesses, like for example, the Airbnbs.
Did you try to access anything when you were there that you weren't able to that appeared to be blocked? I'm curious how much of a Great Firewall of China situation there is. Is Cuba allowing pretty open access to everything as long as they monitor
it? I think that the difficulty is only that it's so time limited and so slow and so expensive for the average person that you can't really, it's not like you can live stream, you know, filming the police or whatever. And it's not like you can, you know, it's not like you can, I guess you could use Twitter. I don't see why not, but maybe it's blocked. I don't know. But it just seems like a much more difficult proposition to like, who has time for Twitter when you only have like 1 hour, you know?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it would seem that Twitter would be a pretty...
a pretty useful thing for that.
Well,
yeah.
Maybe if you could do like Twitter over SMS would be even better. Because
sure.
It's not data or time intensive to, and I guess that's almost getting back to the old BBS model where you log in, you push up your upload and you pull down all the information and then you can go read it at your leisure after you've disconnected.
Yeah. All right. I'll have to look at that. I'm sure they have a large, Twitter, community. And of course, and the article said that, you know, more and more people are listening to, what was it, that guy's YouTube channel? I thought it was YouTube. Let me make sure it says that.
Yeah, I
right, yeah. I think he was saying that his YouTube channel is now being listened to, you know, it was more people in Spain and the U.S., and that makes sense because Spain has the common language.
This was a guy who was, I believe, living in Florida somewhere, but he had a Cuban focused channel.
Oh, he lives in Florida.
But with the opening, all of a sudden, he's getting a lot more followers and people viewing it from Cuba.
Gotcha.
I believe that was the story.
Okay. So yeah, so you absolutely can do YouTube and Twitter and all those things. It's not that easy for the average person. You're not going to have like hundreds of thousands of people tuning in on the island. Actually, that might be higher than the population.
There were a couple of things they pointed out with, you know, people observing really, really crummy conditions. And I can't remember the example now, but it was like, you know, a public bathroom somewhere was in disrepair or some other public venue had was not being addressed, and so they either tweeted or emailed or something public to a government official, and all of a sudden it got dealt with.
Oh.
And
And that's so, better so, than so things work here.
Yeah, I can tell you, that's good.
If I point to it, something going on out there, no one's going to care.
It's like, oh gosh, what was the big snowstorm a few years ago where people were tweeting at Cory Booker about...
New Jersey?
You know, yeah, about issues they were having in the snowstorm, and like he would show up and hand out Hot Pockets and help them shovel out their car.
Ooh, interesting.
So it happens.
Yeah.
But not everybody's... Not everybody's a Cory Booker.
Seriously, so. I was right out there the other day, and a guy just... pulled down his pants right in front of me. I'm like, holy shit. I'm like, why? I'm not going to call 311, though. I mean, what are they going to do?
So I guess they were saying that it is causing the government to step up and address problems that maybe that were easier to sweep under the rug before.
Yeah.
Because who are you going to complain to? But if, you know, you can complain to the government and now everybody else can see it. So people can tell when the government is blatantly ignoring.
Yeah, but everyone knows. Look, you walk around Havana. It's not like you have to look far to see a pothole or a building in disrepair. It's like literally everywhere you walk. So it's not like there's anything particularly.
But there's something about it being on the internet and the public embarrassment attached to that.
I guess
is prompting action.
Okay.
The internet is good at one thing. It is good at public shaming.
Right. Right. And there is, and this is something that's very similar. It works very similarly in our country or many other countries.
Yeah. So what it does not appear to be doing is there's no indication that we're looking at the first steps of a, instead of an Arab spring, a Cuban spring.
Now,
No one seems to be predicting that on the basis of this technology being rolled out there. That we may see some gradual changes, but nothing revolutionary. And maybe that's just because Cuba has had their revolution and they're done. Maybe it's the method that this is being rolled out is they're being smart about it and controlling it just enough, but giving it just enough freedom that it's not going to cause them problems.
Well, yeah, there's like,
but I don't see this toppling the Cuban government.
There's kind of a slow creeping acceptance of private businesses. Like I said, with Raul Castro a few years ago, they said, okay, we have to have some private business. They're forced into doing it because modern economy, you have to allow a little bit of internet and they have to bring more money into their country. So they had to allow some private businesses. It's not like the Chinese model where they actually wanted to encourage it. They're basically doing the minimum that they have to. But they felt the need to have to do some because they need to bring revenue into their state. But from their point of view, from the powers that be, they need to kind of balance it so the people don't have too much freedom and too much money to challenge the system. So, and it was interesting when I was there... go ahead.
I was just going to say it'll be interesting to see in 50 or 100 years who
that's a long
who had
time.
The right.
Yeah.
Well, because I think this is going to be a long horizon event. But who had the right path to transition from a socialist government to whatever? Maybe they will never go to a full Western democracy with capitalism. But that transition, because I think. You see it a little bit in China that they want all the benefits, but they also don't want to relinquish the control.
And like Vietnam is a similar model to China.
Well, and you see it in Korea where they're not really moving in that way. Nope. But part of it is because they are so terrified that if they start that process a little bit, they will lose control, and the ruling party will not only lose power, but they're going to lose their lives in the process. They don't want to end up like a Gaddafi.
Well, North Korea is very different.
Raul Castro and. I hadn't even realized he wasn't president anymore until I did some research coming off of this article. But that transitional government in there, maybe they have found kind of the secret sauce for how do we do this without losing our lives, without throwing our country into upheaval, and get to a better place where everyone wants to be. Because rapid change is dangerous, and governments don't like that at all. At least not in their own backyard.
Yeah, no, I mean you kind of see. Man, Cuba would be such an amazing, like, it would be a spot where everyone wanted to go on vacation if they allowed it. But and then there are people who don't want Cuba to change, mostly Americans who are like, oh, it's good you're going to Cuba, you know, before they allow too many Americans in. And then it becomes just and then I'm like, yeah, sure, let's have them keep their depressed economy just so that I can enjoy that. I mean, I don't know, it sounds ridiculous.
Well, as a New Yorker, I'm sure you're very very aware of the conflict surrounding gentrification, and
yeah.
And this has the potential to be like colonial gentrification, just on a scale of nations as opposed to neighborhoods.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't think that the average person there would like object to having more. To more business opportunities, not just more freedom, but there's a lot of freedom that's restricted there. People don't realize, like, beef is illegal.
So do they not have cattle, or is it that it's restricted to very limited?
Limited.
So like you can only get beef from the government beef store.
I don't know. No. I don't think the average person can get it. I think it's only for like diplomat. I could look it up, but it's like you don't want to catch yourself. It's like having like drugs on you here. It's not, you don't want to be caught with that. I think it was because the cows were collectivized at some point, and then people started stealing the cows, and so they needed to crack down on that.
So if you had beef, you were probably poaching.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff about Cuba. Definitely open to being questioned more about my experience there. Now, Cuba and Venezuela have grown very close because they're the only countries. Well, I mean, Cuba kind of helped Venezuela on their way to becoming a socialist nation because Cuba needs some allies, especially since the fall of the Soviet Union. Oh, yeah, you were talking before about transitioning away from the socialist economy. There's the China model. There's the Russia model.
Well, yeah, the Russia model was basically we flip a switch and all of a sudden there are no rules. Yeah. Capitalism, go steal whatever you can and start selling.
Yeah, but actually that worked out very differently in many of the former Soviet countries, like Russia versus Belarus versus Estonia. Estonia worked out very well, you know, so certain countries.
Well, I think to generalize with abandon, the closer the country was to Europe, the more readily they made that shift. And maybe that's because of influences from their neighbors, or maybe it's because they kind of were that way before they became a Soviet republic.
Sure.
and fell under the Iron Curtain. But they seemed to make that shift much more easily than the ones that were deeper within the Soviet Empire.
Gotcha. Yeah. And then there's North Korea, which is continually close yourself off. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe there'll be other countries that transition to a socialist nation. But it could happen. So when I was there, there were all these propaganda signs, like our ally, Venezuela, had a picture of Hugo Chavez. You know, I don't know. We don't really do that in the United States. We're kind of embarrassed by our allies. We don't say our ally, Saudi Arabia. We're like, I don't know.
We talk about the special relationship between the UK and the US.
But we don't have a big picture of the prime minister up there or the queen.
No.
Well,
For years, there was a big billboard up in the Boston area of, and I'm forgetting who the politician was. I want to say it was like Joe Kennedy or something.
Yeah.
There was some program that he'd advocated for that basically provided home heating oil for the for those below the poverty line or something, and it was basically brought to you by our cooperation with the government of Venezuela, and it was Hugo Chavez helping to heat the homes of the less fortunate in the United States, showing how capitalism has failed you, but
picture,
the socialists will save you.
He put his picture here too. Okay, so that's interesting.
So certainly not in the level I expect it was in Cuba.
Well, yeah. Probably about the same. I didn't see it everywhere. Anytime I go to these countries, there's all these political signs everywhere in Cuba, in Nicaragua, even the Dominican Republic, which is more of like a kind of a capitalist country, but a lot of these countries are very, like, all the politicians have their signs everywhere. I guess that's true here too, but not when it's not election time. Unless it always happens to be election time when I'm going to these places, but it seemed like a lot. So let's talk about Venezuela a little bit.
We both mentioned Hugo Chavez,
yeah.
who is probably the most famous leader of Venezuela, but he has been out of the picture for a number of years.
Yeah,
now.
He died in 2013,
and so I guess he outlived Fidel by a little ways there.
No. Fidel died recently.
Did they both go about the same time?
No. Fidel Castro, I think, stepped down in 2011, but he died.
Oh, that's right.
He died right after the election of 2016 in the U.S.
Oh, I hadn't even realized he'd hung on that long.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, because he stepped down and his brother Raul took over.
Don't you remember?
And then there was a while where nobody knew if he was still alive or not because he hadn't been seen in public.
Don't you remember, like, Trump won and then Castro died and then all your Trump supporter friends were like,
The 2016 election seems so long ago that but that's another topic.
Okay. So we're going to talk about, so in Venezuela you have this interesting situation where Bitcoin might actually have a use case. It's hard to tell how much, but there was a whole write-up on it in the New York Times about a month ago. Tell me what you found there.
Yeah, so the TLDR version of the story in Venezuela in general is they had a booming economy that was heavily based on oil, which was nationalized, and they took advantage of that and expanded their social programs immensely. And then the oil market kind of collapsed out from under them, and they had all these huge expenditures they could no longer finance. And so the government is kind of collapsing under its own weight, and they have ridiculous inflation.
That's the problem. One problem with the socialist economy that people don't understand. Socialist economies can be successful if they take the structure of production that was learned through the previous free market-ish capitalist economy, take that and freeze it into place, because that works. But once the...
Well, it works until something changes.
Until there's a huge shock.
It doesn't have the updating mechanisms that the market
does. Exactly. And that's why, you know, even a place like the Gulf, the Gulf states, like Saudi Arabia, you know, people are like, well, Venezuela is only suffering because of the oil price, but how come these other countries that are not exactly Western countries are doing just fine? You know, so
they've certainly had to adjust their approach, but they're not seeing million plus percent inflation. And,
of course,
and this is legitimately a scenario that's on par with was it Zimbabwe, where they just kept adding zeros to the currency,
yeah,
because inflation was going up,
or
so
removing
quickly.
Zeros or whatever. Yeah. The zeros kept coming because people needed more and more money, and then they have to. Yeah, so inflation is terrible. It destroys the savings of the average person, because it's usually ends up being who ends up holding the hot potato. You know, everyone's trying to spend as fast as they can, and whoever ends up holding the most fiat, someone's got to end up with it in the end. And it's usually not the rich and powerful. It's usually the middle class who ends up getting.
So to accompany this inflationary issue, they also have massive production issues. And so there's shortages of food. Bread is a major staple, and there is not enough to feed people. There have been cases where they've placed additional police at the zoo because people were trying to capture and eat the zoo animals because there was no food.
Yeah.
There was some statistic about and I don't remember the numbers, but it was like the average Venezuelan has lost more in the last several months than anyone on an aggressive diet could expect to lose, because the basic things you need for survival are in short supply.
It's really just, I can't imagine figuring out cryptocurrency in that environment.
Yeah, so there are two things there. One is that you need to be able to get food.
Yeah.
And if there's a limited supply, then the, you know, outside of those places where the government has artificially fixed the price, which will cause there to be less supply available. But where you can get it at a market rate, that rate's going to be extremely high. And because there's also inflation, the money that you do have doesn't go as far.
Right. It has to be money that you just earned.
It's a double whammy there.
It has to be money that you just earned today that you could then turn over really fast.
So one way to hedge around that is investment in some other currency. And because of government regulations, it sounds like it's heavily restricted on what you can convert the Venezuelan, is it bolivars?
The bolivars, yeah.
They heavily restrict what you can convert that into. So it's not like you could go to the bank and say, well, I want to convert this into dollars so that it holds its value, or even into, you know, Mexican pesos or gold. That you can do that in very, very small increments, if at all. And not at a rate that is equivalent to the market rate, because they're artificially suppressing it. So it may be that the actual exchange rate is 100 bolivars to the dollar. But the bank will only give you, a much worse rate, because that's what the government is saying it's pegged to, so it doesn't look as bad as it actually is. The other piece is, so because you can't do that with other standard currencies, one thing that you can potentially do is convert that into crypto, because the government has a lot less ability to restrict.
So that. What wallets are they using? I mean, I've seen an example of some of them are using this SMS wallet, which I'm not familiar with, but I have used some SMS type tools where you could actually, send and receive Bitcoin through SMS. Are they using, apps?
Yeah, I know that, less about that, although it sounds like not only can you not convert funds into foreign currency, but they're also restricting how much you can withdraw from your own bank accounts at a time. Mm. And so that's playing into, how much can you convert into Bitcoin?
Well, I assume
or move around as well.
Since they're doing localbitcoins.com, I assume they're doing like Bitcoins for cash on the street, right?
Yes.
Which I've never done. But I assume, you give someone cash and then they send you Bitcoin either from their phone app or from an SMS app. It sounds very, it sounds all very, not very safe, but when your currency is falling, then it's the best.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't get your money out of the bank, or the money you have in the bank is worthless, you might lose some of your Bitcoin, but if you can't use it, then it's worth about as much as if you get ripped off.
Yeah, and Bitcoin is hard money.
So it becomes worth the risk.
Yeah, it is.
And that's the other thing is that because Bitcoin knows no borders, if you can find a way to convert Bitcoin into local currency, you can get friends and family outside of Venezuela to send you Bitcoin.
Oh, sure.
Which you can then convert, which they, even if they could do it through, a traditional wire, money wire or a Western Union or whatever, again, you're running into restrictions on what you can do there. Plus, there are all sorts of fees associated.
Now, I don't know if we have any pictures of that, but if someone has a wallet down there, and there is no limit to how much Bitcoin they can be sent into that wallet. Someone could send $100,000, $1 million if they want.
They may have trouble converting that into cash on the street.
Yeah.
With the local markets there, but certainly it puts them in a stronger position.
I haven't read any examples of this actually happening. I can't imagine it's not. But if it is, it's probably not a huge number of people who have figured this out.
And this ties into, something you talked about with, was it Charlie?
Charlie Oliver on Tech 2025.
Yeah, Charlie Oliver on Tech 2025.
That was a good show, by the way.
The episode that just recently came
out. Yeah, that was out recently. It was on that show. You should check it out. I'll put it on the website.
But you were talking about potentially people like fleeing in a refugee situation, that cryptocurrency allows you to convert all your assets into this electronic form, and then you don't have to worry about smuggling bags of cash across the border or getting ripped off. Or how to convert it, as you're traveling.
It's still there's still
it's
risks,
completely locked up and safe. Yeah. And there have been people who've, I think the example they gave in the article was was someone who was able to use that to leave Venezuela. Unfortunately, they ended up having to come back because whatever it was they tried to do where they went didn't pan out. But it gave them the opportunity at least to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Where otherwise they might have been trapped in an ever-worsening
situation. You have several options there. I mean, you could try to bring your private key with you in like a little in like a little envelope or something in your pocket and hope they don't get it. You can send the Bitcoin to someone in the foreign country, hope they have it for you, or you could remember it. I would say probably try to do a combination of those things because that way if one of them doesn't work, you're still in luck. But but it's way easier. Like, I think the idea of the era of government confiscating all assets might be over to an extent.
Well, the tricky bit becomes how do you convert everything into crypto?
Right. To begin with.
Because some assets that can be done more easily than others.
But I'm thinking in the far future, or not in the near future, like people will have their some assets in crypto.
Yeah, well, and it'll mean less hedging with durable goods.
Yeah.
Like in the World War II example with the Jews or other persecuted groups fleeing Europe. There was, we're going to, hide our jewels. We'll sew them into our clothes, into our luggage,
sure.
And get our wealth out that way. It wouldn't be that easy today to go convert, a diamond ring into crypto. At least not as easy
sure.
as to convert, a bank balance.
Yeah.
But if you have that method, then you wouldn't need to store your wealth in, gold coins or jewelry to begin with.
Right.
Assuming you have confidence in the currency, the cryptocurrency. And the other thing worth pointing out here is speaking of confidence in the cryptocurrency, crypto is maybe not at record lows right now, but it's certainly far off of its peak. And yet, it is still a much more stable store of value than their local currency. And so it is proving to be a superior currency, despite all of the criticisms that you might be able to level at it about, its fluctuation and this and that. It's still doing better than they are. So it brings, I'm using value in multiple contexts here, but it brings value to the table in that fashion.
Yeah, a big difference is sometimes like cryptocurrency or Bitcoin is volatile on the upside. It's not like when you have a currency that they're inflating, it's not like it increases its value significantly one day. It really doesn't happen. It's only going down. So if you have something that's going both up and down, you could maybe live with it. And especially now, this happens. I've seen this happen to crypto, to Bitcoin a lot, like in 2015, where it goes down so low, it's kind of packed into a permanent low level that it sort of reaches a floor, and then everyone's like, oh, we found the floor, and then it goes down a little more. But like eventually we do find the floor, and it seems like they found a floor right now because it's been at like in the 3,000s or 4,000 for several months, and I don't think it's going much lower than that. So
knock on wood.
Yeah, sure. All right. So let's see what else we have to say here. Right.
Well, so I don't think we've mentioned the blackout.
So
blackout. When we first read this article, things were bad. But then all of a sudden, the Capitol and the surrounding area started going through extended rolling blackouts for pretty much most of the day for several day long periods.
Right.
And I don't know, is that still going on?
I think
today?
The blackout is over.
Okay.
But who knows? It could come back.
Yeah. So this was a country that was already teetering on the edge of revolution. They've got two people who've claimed to be president. They've got outside aid that the military is refusing to let in.
The opposition, Guaido, by the way, is pro crypto.
Yeah, and so it's this is a country that is primed for a potentially violent overthrow of the government.
So I also read, though,
Then you cut the power to the largest population center. I was shocked that there were not more people dying in the streets. And for a while, it was unclear, are they? And we just can't find out about it because there's no power and no reporters.
It's very hard to figure out what's going on in that country right now.
But it sounds like even with the power out, people were finding ways to take advantage of cryptocurrency to keep themselves fed and roofs over their
heads.
That's
crazy, right? I mean, it can't be that many people. This is such a tough technology to figure out. Have you ever tried to buy Bitcoin? It's like,
necessity is the mother of, well, maybe not invention in this case, but figuring shit out.
Yeah. Well, look, so people have said, well, volume dipped in Venezuela during this time, which, you know, could be said, well, you know, that's not good for Bitcoin because Bitcoin can't be used during a power outage. But it also kind of proves the point that, well, maybe it really is being used. I'm not sure if that's, it could be volume dipped for other reasons. And right. So I'm not sure if volume dipped in Venezuela or dipped else, but people have speculated that. It's very interesting to read.
And this is a case where people are buying in or, you know, transacting in volume, and it's not purely speculation.
Yeah. So there's also,
I mean, these people are using it to buy things and not just like for the novelty of, oh, I bought a pizza with Bitcoin. It's no, this is the best way for me to carry out this necessary task.
Yeah, but I just don't think it's like a huge percentage of the population. I could be wrong. Like,
I wouldn't expect
that.
But
it's like a few people who have figured out. Man, it's so hard to, we'll be following this story, I guess, in the future, because it's so hard to figure out, you know, what kind of numbers we're talking about here. One of the interesting things I found is that people continued to use it during the blackout because the SMS networks are still up and you can send Bitcoin through text message. So that, so long as you can find a way to charge your phone, which people, I guess you do through what, like solar charging?
Solar or even, I've seen some, well, I don't know if it's enough to power a phone battery, but, you know, those emergency radios with the hand crank that's got a little charger in it. And
yeah.
There are ways around it. You know, I mean, if you remember when was it Sandy came through New York City?
Yeah.
There were... Even when most of the power was out, there were places where you could find power and you could charge stuff up,
sure.
Whether it was because somebody had a generator.
I just had to walk up to 42nd Street.
Yeah.
Or 40th Street. And then go to the nicest hotel. Like go to the Waldorf Astoria.
I'd be interested to see, to find out more info on whether they were able to use crypto at any point of sale, or if it was all these exchanging crypto,
like barter type thing,
for local currency and then spending the bolivars type thing.
Yeah.
Because there was an article I saw about how during the prolonged blackout, the high-end steakhouses in the capital were doing booming business, because if you still had, you know, if you were well off enough that you had enough cash, you could go there because they had generators, they had power, they had food, they had good food. You know, the booze was still being poured, and it seemed like that was one of a small handful of places where you could go in and kind of shut out the fact that the world seems to be falling apart outside and be completely oblivious.
Wait, where
to
was
it.
This?
At least, so these were like the high end steakhouses in the capital
in Venezuela.
In Venezuela.
Oh, okay, interesting. All right, so this article and like a few other things have some examples of, okay, can this technology still be used, you know, in a blackout situation? So one of them is SMS, but then there's sort of the idea of
I'd have serious concerns about the security of that, but I think we may have mentioned before that, you know, even if it's risky, it beats not having any cash
right.
And any way to buy things.
So other solutions, another one they said is mesh networks, which is a little bit hand wavy right now. I don't think they were like a satellite, like, okay, fine. The two that I could think off the top of my head are, well, there are actually physical, almost like paper backed by Bitcoin, or the physical Bitcoins that someone actually built where it's got the public key up front and then the private key is inside it. And so if you do have access to the internet, you can verify it. But, you know, you kind of figure it's probably in there if you don't. That's probably not the best solution. That's more like just trying to exchange something physical. The Lightning Network is an interesting one, because the way the Lightning Network works, and this is one of the ways to scale Bitcoin, is that, for example, me and you will open an account with each other, right? We both put in $50, and then the idea is we can exchange back and forth amongst ourselves by updating a stream of transactions with each other, without the use of without actually publishing to the blockchain until we're done. And then when you get a whole network of that, you can
Now this is part of Bitcoin Classic, or is
this is a second layer solution built on top of Bitcoin. But my idea is
But it's part of Bitcoin, not what was it? Bitcoin Cash.
No, split off. Bitcoin Cash.
Okay. Because wasn't that part of the debate was over
this building is the alternative
multiple yeah. layers or changing the block
yeah, this
size?
This is the multiple layer that the main Bitcoin wants to do. Or at least it's one solution that they're trying out. So if you and I have a channel open with each other, we can transact anytime as much as we want without access to any internet connection. Now the question is, does that actually work? You know, in a non-connected situation, because I would have to transact. Like, let's say you wanted to transact with someone else, but maybe you're both connected through me. You know, would you have to contact me directly and be like, you know, hey, but I don't know. Maybe there's something with that. Well, at least if I have something open with a bunch of people in town, like a bunch of stores in town, I might be able to do something there. I don't know. As a long-term solution, it seems like a possibility.
It's starting to sound like one of the more complicated word problems on the SATs.
Yeah. Perhaps. Okay. So just want to wrap this up. Just want to give a conclusion on what we've discovered through this theme this week. I think these technologies have definitely helped on the margins to mitigate some of the social and economic problems in these countries so far, and it's definitely helped change lives, both in Cuba and Venezuela, with the small businesses opening up in Cuba and people using crypto to feed themselves, feed their families in Venezuela. But it's still small numbers of people. So far, no magic bullet to force these regimes to reform or to allow citizens to overthrow these regimes. And that's sort of the purpose of these technologies, is to affect big changes, not just in Cuba and Venezuela, but all over the world. Like, you know, with Bitcoin, people want to see, some people want to see the end of fiat money. They want to see a return to sound money across the world. That's a big change in the U.S. too. So far...
Because we've been off the gold standard since what? Was it sometime in the 70s?
Completely off in the 70s, I think partially off in like the 40s.
30s, 40s.
Yeah. And I don't know when the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, what that did. So anyway, I would have to go back and answer that. So the open question is, what changes in the future? Does this change in the future? Technologies and interconnectivity, does it continue to simply make changes at the margins and perhaps grow a little bit, or does it lead to some big fast change or some some turning of the corner, if you will, at some point? It's remained to be seen, but I'd like to hear from the audience here on what you think is going to happen. localmaxradio@gmail.com. That's my conclusion from today's stories. Aaron, I'll let you have the last word.
Yeah, I think these are two different mediums, but they're both looking at getting more information to more people to use more freely, and I think there might be some growing pains along the way, but the net result is going to be positive for all parties involved.
You're talking about information and money.
Yeah.
Information and value.
And some would argue that money is just another form of information.
It is, but it's a very different form.
Having access to more of it and being able to exchange it with fewer restrictions, whether we're talking about money or information, I think is good all around. So I like you posed the question, I don't know if this is going to show cause radical change or gradual change, but it's going to be change for the better, I think, across the board.
All right. I think the people involved want radical change, so in both these countries and ours. So we'll see. All right. I think that's about it. I think it's time to wrap up. Next week, I have some pretty neat interviews planned in the future. I've got my friend Bethany Crystal. She works at Union Square Ventures investment VC, and they funded Foursquare. They funded all sorts of stuff, and she's a really cool Medium. She does some really great Medium posts about life and productivity. So I'm going to ask about that. I'm going to be hopefully, if this scheduling works out, I'm going to be talking to Hillary Mason next week. Very well-known data scientist, machine learning person here in New York City. Office right out there. She founded Fast Forward Labs, and now they're part of Cloudera. So I'm going to do that interview. A few more coming down the line. So excited about that. And you'll be able to listen to that the next few weeks on the Local Maximum. So have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account at Max Sklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.
And she said, I don't care what you say, you're gonna see me shine.